Hello, and welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine, and for this episode, we have a story featuring the redoubtable Dr. John H. Watson, written and read by James Tipton. The Beast of Eastdale Tarn was published in our March-April 2021 issue. A novelist and poet, and of course a fan of the Arthur Conan Doyle stories, James Tipton teaches literature and creative writing at the College of Marin in California.
Adieu, je t'aime par la vie. Annette Vallone in correspondence to William Wordsworth. Part 1. A Large Cat. In mid-July, in the year 88, a year full of a number of strange cases, I was trying to distract myself from the smell of fumes arising from the test tubes of my friend Sherlock Holmes. Even a stroll in Regent's Park held no escape. At the beginning of a hot, muggy day, the windows were already open upon the stagnant air of London. With stench within and impurity without, I turned to Mr. Kipling. "Listen to this, Holmes," I said. "A friend of mine at the India Club gave me this. It's not even published yet." Holmes didn't look up from his fascinating, bubbling creations, but I continued anyway. "There was 30 dead and wounded on the ground we wouldn't keep. No, there wasn't more than 20 when the front began to go. That describes how it was, stuck on that baking Afghan plain with enemy hordes surrounding us. Mr. Kipling knows the voice of the common soldier." Without looking up, Holmes answered, "There might be some virtue in sounding like a private in Her Majesty's army, but long before Mr. Kipling, Mr. Wordsworth wrote in common speech that was a bit more elevating." And with his eye on measuring some liquid in his test tube, Holmes recited, "That serene and blessed mood, in which the affections gently lead us on, until the breath of this corporeal frame, and even the motion of our human blood, almost suspended, we are laid asleep in body and become a living soul." If you're curious about my methods, Watson, that passage accurately describes my state of mind when I smoke and think and smoke and think, and out of that mist, a form takes shape and becomes the solution of the problem. "You amaze me, Holmes. I had no idea you knew any poetry at all. I came across the passage quite by accident when I was researching information on the great forger Henry Wollstone. I committed the lines to memory and moved on. Otherwise, you're quite correct. I have not the time, and the mansion of the human brain, though vast with many intricate corridors, only has so many spare rooms. One must be chary with what one puts in it. For instance, one wouldn't want to crowd out Simon Grimswald for a poem by William Wordsworth." "Wouldn't want that." Holmes looked up from his test tubes and narrowed his eyes at me. I smiled. "Humor is not your strong point, Watson. Grimswald was a notorious multiple murderer in Bristol in 61. You were what, 7 years old?" Holmes was again addressing his test tubes. "His peculiarity was that he only killed retired sea captains." I stifled a laugh. "Holmes, you're making this up. Who had once been involved in the slave trade. He modeled himself after the American abolitionist John Brown. I was saved further ruminations on multiple murderers of the 60s by a knock on the door." Without waiting for a reply, Mrs. Hudson entered the room with a disagreeable expression on her face. "Mr. Holmes, you really must do something about your experiments. I can smell this one downstairs." She held out a brass salver with a letter on it addressed to Holmes. "This just arrived in the Morning Post," she said. Still speaking to the test tube, Holmes said, "Please leave it on the tea table, Mrs. Hudson. Thank you very much." As the table was several steps closer to Holmes' laboratory, Mrs. Hudson seemingly held her breath, deposited the salver, and didn't lose any time in leaving the room. "Would you be so kind, Watson, as to forsake your Kipling and read the letter to me? I really do not have time to embark on any further investigations, but I am curious." I picked up the envelope, noticed the fine paper, broke the wax seal with the initials C.H., and read a most unusual message. Dear Mr. Holmes, you may have heard of a big cat that terrorizes the Lake District near the village of Grasmere. It is like a leopard without spots, and has been seen crossing country lanes, walking along stone walls, and slinking away from the carcasses of calves and sheep. It is partly on behalf of the sheep farmers that I write you, but really, because of my professional curiosity, I am a lecturer at the Royal Agricultural University in Lancaster. The tooth imprints suggest a big cat. That is, the spacing of the three points of the teeth on a sheep bone are larger than a dog or a fox could produce, and correspond with the carnassial tooth of a large cat. This tooth imprint data points to the presence of a carnivore bigger than any indigenous to Britain for the past 24,000 years. A patrol of Royal Marines has investigated the area of these sightings in the Lake District, but has found nothing. The farmers in the north and I would be most grateful if you could, with your peculiar talents, unravel the problem of these mysterious sheep killings. My university will defray your expenses and, upon discovering essential evidence, will reward you for your services. You may call upon me at the university on your way north, should you choose to follow this investigation. I remain, sir, your obedient servant, Christopher Harwell, lecturer. I heard a sudden outburst of laughter from Holmes. He looked up from his tubes. Ha! Where the Royal Marines have failed, they send in Sherlock Holmes, do they? Peculiar talents. Well, they'll have to wait this time. Brother Mycroft has me on a matter of some importance to European economy. Some clever fellow has flooded the diamond market with exact replicas. How does one create a false diamond so as to confuse experts? I'm on my way to find out. Then on my way to Amsterdam. No, this cannot wait. But, Watson, this sounds like something you should pursue on your own. I'm obliged to answer the small chaos caused by a diamond forger. You may find glory in pursuing the mystery of the elusive northern beast. But, Holmes, do you have patients who need immediate attention? Hardly. Then you know my methods. You've been reporting, embellishing them, I might add. Don't embellish. Take a lesson from Messrs. Kipling and Wordsworth and report the simple glory of the facts. You'll be going to Wordsworth country, by the way. Holmes, I know nothing of big cats and sheep. What is there to know? You follow tracks. You follow animal droppings, checking them for whatever remains. You wait behind a rock on some windy fell, and you have your creature. I protested further, but Holmes was adamant. Then he added this. You've been wanting out of London, and the summer heat and stagnant air. Don't say you haven't. Breathe that northern clean air, and your mind will swiftly arrive at a conclusion to this confounding question. There is a train bound for the north leaving Euston at 1 p.m., just time for a spot of lunch. Part 2. The French Letter. I will not bore the reader with details of how I met with Mr. Harwell, continued north at his bidding by train to Windermere, then coach to the village of Grasmere. For 2 days I wandered the steep, rocky fells of Lothrig and Easedale, where many of these sightings had occurred. I talked to farmers and shepherds and proprietors of inns about mutilated sheep carcasses and enormous black cats jumping over hedges. I had even seen some suspicious tracks and examined, as Holmes suggested, droppings that contained, I believed, sheep intestines. The lecturer had provided me with photographs of various tooth imprints, and without Holmes's double lens, I dropped to my knees many times and looked closely at sheep, wild boar, and silka deer bones. I came to conclude, with the lecturer, that the imprint suggested that some type of cat larger than domestic or wild cat had bitten the animals. But I was no closer to finding the cat itself than had the Royal Marines. On the evening of the third day, near a flock of sheep on the fell, I crouched behind a rock, my ears alert to every sound other than the keening wind, my eyes to any sight of movement beyond the gentle grazing of the sheep. Then I wound my way back, down the rocky path toward the inn and a fire. I wanted to make Holmes proud, but was afraid I was destined only to show how plebeian I was, compared with his marvelous faculties. I was near the bottom of the slope when, in the shrouding darkness of a northern night, I slipped on some loose pebbles and fell flat on my face, onto rocks. I was just rising when a hand out of woolen sleeve appeared before my face. I took it. It was a woman's hand, soft but strong, that helped me rise to my knees, then to my feet. "Are you hurt, sir?" the woman asked. I did a quick check. "No, probably just a bruise, thank you. But may I ask what brings you out on the fell this time of night?" "You, sir, I was looking for you. Here, take my arm. The stones are badly spaced here, and I know the path." We continued for some time in silence down the rest of the fell. I could feel soreness in my knees, hands, and face. When the path had leveled out, I asked, "What is it, miss, that you wanted to see me about?" I looked at her, and under her hat, in the dim light, I could discern not unattractive features. She was blonde, wore a simple blue dress, with an ornament of a bird pinned to the side of her chapeau. She seemed in her late 20s, and her voice betrayed an accent I thought French. "It is not the beast which you seek," she said. "It is something far more sinister. It is human. Please, of what do you prefer?" The lights of the village were now twinkling in the vale below us. "I believe someone is trying to blackmail my master, the owner of Rydal Mount, Mr. Wordsworth. I am governess to his children, and I sometimes help out with domestic tasks as well. In order to look for books, I went into his study, which was also the study at the top of the house of the old poet, his grandfather, of whom you may have heard. I know his grandfather's hand, for I have, in my curious moments, and in the task of teaching his children, come upon the drafts of his writings and correspondences. There was a pile of these now, on the desk, and my master was making a clearance, keeping some and throwing others in the grate. Having procured one book, I went to pick up the tea-tray that was on the desk. In doing so, I noticed a letter on the top in a female hand. Mr. Wordsworth said gruffly, "Don't bother," and waved me away, which wasn't his way at all. I left without finding the second book. When I returned later to look for it, after Mr. Wordsworth had gone, I noticed the pile of letters on the desk was smaller. The letters, different from the other papers, had once been carefully wrapped, I would say preserved, in brown paper, with the remains of twine around the paper on the table. We had slowed our pace somewhat, the path having veered through a pasture, over a stile, through a small wood, and over a stone bridge, now turned into the road, along which were strong outlined cottages and a couple large houses. My soreness was palpable, but I ignored it. My guest now, in the thin light from a cottage window, paused, touched my arm, and looked into my face. "I think your face is already colored from the bruise," she said. "My heart is somewhat bruised from what I must next tell you, but it led me to my suspicions." She resumed her slow pace. "I know I should not have done what I did, Dr. Watson. Yes, everyone in the village knows your name and of your association with your distinguished colleague." I secretly glowed at the word colleague. "I told you before I witnessed a female hand," she continued. "Curiosity was too much, and I thought it would do no harm if I took a peek. I saw it was in French. Now I know French, for I am Belge myself. What I read astounded me. It was so full of emotion. The writing was small, even in the margin, taking up every inch of space. It went something like, 'She looks like you. When I hold her in my arms, I see your face. When are you returning?' I slapped that letter right down, feeling I was trespassing, and worried someone would walk in. I left for the door. Then the sin of curiosity took hold of me again, and I picked up that top letter, intending to go to my room and peruse it at my leisure, then return it, no harm done. But as I left the study, I was startled by the butler. 'What was he doing up here at the top of the house?' Dropped the letter in the hall, and was too frightened to pick it up. I couldn't sleep, and when, with a small candle, I went back down to the hall, the letter was not there. I went into the study, and it was not on the pile of letters or other papers. The next day my master looked distracted and was so ill-tempered, I feared the letter could have fallen into wrong hands. It was by a French woman, no doubt, writing as if she and the poet were on intimate terms, and even implying there was a child. Very compromising stuff, I would think, and carefully preserved for almost a century, first by the poet himself, then by his son, but his grandson, who was writing a biography of the great man, was trying to get rid of it and others like it. You suspect someone in the house? The afternoon after the night I dropped the letter, I noticed Richard Ashman, the fellow who cleans the chimneys, inspecting scraps in the hearth. He's not supposed to do that, is he? I know Hamlet says, "Frailty, thy name is woman," so you'll have to forgive me, doctor. Self-control is hard to come by, but I never did anything wrong, did I, that would hurt someone? I just dropped a letter. Ashman has other clients. He could have found and sold the letter. I imagine there would be some who would pay grandly for such a letter, the old Mr. Wordsworth being as famous as he is, the poet laureate and all. Then there's the butler, Mr. Arthur Thornton, a penny-pinching man who might want an extra penny. What has any of this to do with the beast I am looking for? Has no one told you there are oriental animals that roam the fells sometime? No one has told me this. And I wondered about the veracity and the intentions of my walking companion. Could she be a gossip-monger or a story-teller out to amuse herself at the expense of the gentleman who has a famous colleague in London? I can't tell you any more tonight, she said. As we're near the inn, and there are folk who would speak ill if they saw us out walking together. But ask someone in the inn about oriental animals and to whom they belong. If you want to hear more, I can meet you around 7 in the evening at the place you fell on the fell. That's a joke, Dr. Watson, though probably not to you who fell. She then uttered a charming, light, most innocent, childlike laugh, which floated around her like a sudden flight of busy larks, in extreme contrast with the dark matter of blackmail she had brought to me, as if it all ultimately didn't touch her. If you are not there, she said, I will go home and assume you are not interested. She paused. I could think of nothing to say to this loquacious Flamand. Oh, you're wondering, she said, how I could meet you here when I live in Rydal Mount. I work there, but I live here, in Grasmere. I love this village. The Royal Mail coach takes me in the morning, along the lake and back in the evening for a tuppence. What is your name? I finally asked. Laura Jacobs. I hope your bruises heal quickly. And with that, she went down the quiet street, the little bird in her hat bobbing as if on a branch in the country evening, until she turned a corner, and she and her strange story were gone. Part 3. Don't believe her or him. I entered the warm light of the inn, and the bartender said, You get into a fight, doctor? No, I said, I fell at the bottom of the fell. Please give me a pint of your best bitter and a mutton pie. I've seen enough sheep today. I sat on a stool at the bar, and when the bartender, Jake Carpenter was his name, handed me my pint, when I had taken a long draught, I asked him if he had heard anything about oriental animals in the area. Of course, he said. Everybody knows that, everybody except those Royal Marines who was here. Why didn't you tell them? Nobody asked. Listen, the big cats are not just souvenirs from distant travels. They are a part of our lore for centuries. Probably 1,000 years. Big cats in Scotland, big cats in Cornwall and Exmoor. Wherever there is space for them to roam and sheep for them to eat. There's a lot of places in Britain. I saw one myself, casually strolling along the top of a low stone wall. He wasn't a leopard from India. He was one of our big cats. But if you want to ask the gentleman who owns oriental animals, ask that Canadian writer, David Thoreau, or that old war hero from India, John Black. They live each in big houses along the Easdale Fell Road. You'll probably walk right past them. You want another pint? Take the sting out of your two black eyes? The next day at my hotel, the Wordsworth Hotel, complete with stationery with a copy of the poet's signature scrawled at the top, I had 2 visitors who came in succession as if they had planned it between breakfast and lunch. The first I met while I still enjoyed my coffee in the dining room, and it was the butler, Mr. Arthur Thornton. He was tall and imposing, as butlers, I suppose, are supposed to be. I've never had one myself. With a supercilious manner, I motioned for him to sit at my table and ordered a coffee for him. He sat rigidly and at the edge of the chair as if he were about to vacate it at any moment. He didn't touch the coffee. I understand, he began, that the indiscreet governess, not the best example for the children, but that's not for me to say, may have reported something of a possibly purloined letter. Don't believe her. There is no letter missing. She is a lover of tales. She has the children reading novels. He pronounced the word in utter distaste. One about a fellow governess who discovers an insane wife locked in an attic, I tell you. I came upon her reading the passage aloud, and the children's mouths were agape. But the least said, the better. Suffice it to say, she has a fertile imagination fueled by her indecorous reading. What makes you think she mentioned such a letter to me? The indiscreet woman, typical of her Gallic breed, told me herself, rather proudly. She said, "Justice is on its way." I think she is deranged myself. He rose and stood stiffly. My coffee cup stayed in mid-air as I hung fire for his parting comment. "I just came to warn you. It is my duty. Good day." "Pardon me, Mr. Thornton, but I have just two things to say. First, that this matter of the letter and the girl's veracity that concerns you so, that is really none of my business. That is not why I am here. And second, as a butler of some refinement, you speak French, order French wines?" "Of course, that is part of my job." The butler looked at me questioningly, then abruptly turned on his heel and left the Wordsworth Hotel. I was feeling rather overwhelmed by this sudden onslaught of conflicting or irrelevant information, so unsure about my next course of action, I sat in an armchair in the lobby and picked up the Times. If one is in a state of indecision, one can always read a newspaper and feel that one is doing something useful. Finding nothing about Holmes's counterfeit diamonds or anything else of note, I glanced at the Manchester Morning Star, which seemed to have more gossip than news. Then my undecided course of action took care of itself. A short, plump, gray-haired and primly dressed woman entered, asked at the desk for me, and took her seat on the couch opposite, keeping her distance. She announced herself as Mrs. Harrison, the housekeeper of Rydal Mount. "I understand," she said, "that the taciturn and superior Mr. Thornton has been to see you. He has distaste for anyone and everyone except for his spaniel. He is a thoroughly disagreeable man, and I wouldn't believe a word he said. Everything for him is filtered through his own misanthropic nature. For myself, I am no champion of Miss Jacobs, but I am equally not a champion of the master I have served for 10 years now. Other fine houses that I ran had masters whose kindness was expressed much more liberally in the wages they gave. To speak plainly, I plan to give my notice soon. My present master, perhaps, has come upon hard times, and that is why he is trying to write that biography. This lack of liberality may not be his fault. I'm just saying, he may not be amiss to making a little on the side, on the name of his famous ancestor. That's all I am saying." "You mistake my purpose here, madame," I said. "If your butler is a misanthrope, if your master is tight-fisted or open-handed, or if Miss Jacobs is the goddess of truth itself or not, is not my concern. And that's all I'm saying." And the good lady was up and off in a swish of stiff skirts. Part 4. Foreign Ways. So I made a decision not to follow up any letter, real or fanciful, of some long-lost French lover to a highly respected English poet, but to continue my investigation, which had got lost in the muddle that started with my interview with Miss Jacobs. Still, I had a hard time believing anyone so sweet-natured and attractive could be guilty of anything other than the curiosity to which she herself confessed. But I shook my head to free myself from those thoughts. Holmes was not anything if he was not fully concentrated on the case at hand, and would never let himself be led off the path, especially by an attractive woman. So I decided to make a call of my own at the homes of the gentleman who purportedly owned the exotic animals. I inquired about their addresses at the concierge desk, upon which the concierge discreetly asked about my eyes. I said I had had a fall. He wanted to know if I had fallen in the hotel. When I told him no, his interest in my face waned, and he gave me the addresses. I was passing through one of the narrow lanes of Grasmere, a village perhaps 3 streets wide, when out of the door of the Methodist chapel, which opened immediately upon the street, a scarecrow of a man in a bowler hat too big for him came down the 3 stone steps and on to the road beside me. "Mrs. Harrison has been to see me," he explained. "She was very upset that a scandal could ensue by you listening to that Frenchwoman." I was about to say that she was Belgian, and that that wasn't the message Mrs. Harrison told me, but I thought my job was to listen, so I listened. "My name is Parson Thirdly," he said, "and people tell me things they don't feel free to say to others. I'm only passing it on to you, for you are the agent of law and order as I see it. There's only one problem in this lovely parish, so distant from the sin and vices of the big cities, and that's the encroachment of foreigners. Even here, maids, waiters, governesses. There's no telling where they might show up. At any rate, I preach conscientiously against fleshly temptation, which continental types seem not to care about, and foreign ways creeping into and corrupting England. There was a rumor, so said Mrs. Harrison, that our great local poet had succumbed to foreign temptation, a rumor started, no doubt, by that French governess. So you are suspicious of anything French? I asked. Even, the parson said, of demon cats from foreign shores. There's those around here, too. Keep your wits about you, doctor. Don't get taken in. I thanked him for his invaluable advice about foreigners and big cats. Just doing my duty to my parish, he said, and Parson Thirdly turned down an alley called Chapel Lane. I watched his narrow back for a moment, then crossed the street at a hanging sign that read, Sam Reed, Bookseller. There, to my astonishment and pride, was A Study in Scarlet, among other books, in the window. I thought, with the aid of my peerless editor and agent, Conan Doyle, I should write more stories. I continued past the outlying cottages along Easdale Fell Road. It was a lovely summer day, with white sheep dotting the green fields, and lines of old stone walls crisscrossing across the steep fells and forests lining the tops of crags. There was nothing sinister in it such a day. All tales of demon cats and purloined letters seemed to be just that, tales. I stopped at the Cheval Blanc, its appellation spelled out in iron letters atop the iron gate of the house of the retired Captain John Black. As I had served in the East, I was interested to hear his stories of India. A big, florid man whose white hair still had streaks of blonde answered the door. Yes, he said, as if I were a salesman for whom he had no time. Then he laughed. Get in a fight at the inn, did you? I had a fall on the fell. I realized how silly it sounded. I would have to do better. I am Dr. Watson, making inquiries on behalf of Sherlock Holmes of London. Yes, yes, I've heard of you. Stalking the fells in search of an elusive beast. Come in for a few minutes. And he ushered me into a sitting room with tapestries of Arabian hunting scenes on the walls, one decidedly Indian, in which a turbaned man carried a damsel on his saddle and they rode away from a distant castle under a half-moon. I couldn't discern whether the damsel looked frightened or fascinated. The captain ordered whiskey and soda for us both from a turbaned, stooped servant, and, though barely lunchtime, I sipped my drink. I hear you did service in India. I was in the second Afghan campaign myself, I said. Second opium war for me. The Arrow War, invasion of Canton, New Year's Day, 58. We surprised them, doctor. 15 English dead to 500 Chinese. A small European force capturing a city of 5 million. That was a day. How about you? I was at the Battle of Maiwan. It didn't turn out so gloriously. I heard the French helped at Canton. Yes, but not significantly. But afterwards I returned with them to Pondicherry, resigned my commission, and lived for some time in French India to secure what we had accomplished at Canton. You had accomplished the securing of shipments of opium from India to China? You're not going to go moral on me, are you, doctor? Not like that Right Honorable Prime Minister. What we did was to secure free trade, the essence of all British wealth and influence. It's not the army or navy, it's free trade that has built the empire. The Americans were not too moral to go in with us on that. I put my whiskey back on the table with what I thought was a significant clink of glass on the polished mahogany, and changed the subject. I hear, I said, that you have a souvenir from your time in India, a wild animal. And you think my panther is the beast that eats up the stray sheep of careless farmers? I used to be seen regularly by the villagers as I walked my tame panther on a lead, mind you, up Easdale Fell to the tarn. The tarn is a wild, isolated place. There I would let my panther go for a half hour or so. Then I'd whistle and he'd return. He may have caught a sheep or two on those evenings or not. That may be the end of your mystery. But I sold him a fortnight ago to the Bellevue Manchester Zoo. and nearly broke my old warrior's heart. He was all I lived for. I've no wife or family, just an old devoted servant. My panther and I went on constitutionals every evening. Now I'm getting older, but I still walk up the Easdale Fell, not all the way to the tarn, to Sourmilk Gill, the waterfall, but it's not the same. Captain Black, you whom I believe made a fortune on the opium trade, you make me assume that you have a heart to break. Animals are different than humans, Doctor. What's it to me if a few Chinamen get a bit fond of their opium? But the loss of my pet panther, that's another matter. Why did you sell it, if you were so fond of it? Money, Doctor, free trade, my army stipend and my dividends, as you say, from the opium trade, have grown thin. That war was almost 30 years ago now. I've lived like a rajah here in this remote village where no one questions how I made my money. I'm the war hero of Grasmere. The Bellevue Zoo needed exotic animals and was willing to pay. One cannot be sentimental about business transactions. The days of making virtually unlimited profit through the empire faded when the Queen substituted the East India Company with the British Army. I was part of that army, I said. Thank you for your time. I left my whiskey unfinished, and a stooped servant saw me to the door. From the hall, I heard in a booming voice, "Don't forget to call on that colonial, Mr. Thoreau. He has more menace about his house than I ever had. And I had a cheetah once. You should have seen it chase sheep." And I heard a laugh as the big door was closed behind me. At the end of the outlying cottages and houses of the village, at the edge of a sheep pasture and the path into the woods, and up Easdale Fell, stood a large wooden house with a small park of yew trees beside it. A stone wall at least 20 feet high was discernible behind the trees. A tall, dark-haired man in his mid-40s or so answered the door. He knew who I was, invited me in, and his servant, a handsome woman who seemed to be a Native American, served tea. "I prefer cider," Mr. Rowe said, "but the English always feel better if tea is served." "You do not consider yourself English, sir?" "I am a North American. Canadian and always will be. I moved here a few years ago simply because my books were not selling as well as I wanted them to, and my mother's sister willed to me a house in this quaint village. You know St. Oswald's Church, the churchyard in which the poet William Wordsworth is buried, was built in the 13th century? You know what was in North America in the 13th century? Free natives, uncontaminated, undecimated by Europeans. This village is not just quaint, Doctor. It is a bubble in time. Charming bubble. Railroads don't even reach here. That's why that old poet liked it here. The Industrial Revolution never marred its quiet crags. Its lonely tarns reflect stars, not man-made light. What are you writing now?" I asked. "I, too, am a writer, chronicling the adventures of my friend. A novel of North America when the first white men came. The wildness, the freedom, the animals to which they were exposed. I heard a rumor that you still harbor one of those animals." He put his teacup down. "Excuse me a moment, Doctor." When he returned presently, he had a sack in his hand. "Come with me," he said. I followed him out to the small park that I had seen when I approached the house. We went through a pleasant aisle of yew trees, entwined at their base with wild eglantine, up to a thick door. Thoreau put a key in the lock, opened it a crack, and bid me look. He held the door firmly. Inside the rather large enclosure were another yew tree and an oak. The oak was spreading twisted branches. Below the trees ran a narrow stream, emerging out of a pipe in the wall and cascading down into a small pool. It seemed a peaceful, quiet scene. Then I saw it in a swish of dark movement behind the leaves on a long, twisting branch, a leopard without spots. "You see him, Doctor? Isn't he beautiful? He's a puma, native to North America. He longs for it, as I do, and we will have to make do." The puma had sighted us. Thoreau said, "Not dinner yet, mon frere, but maybe tea time." He turned to me. "You will excuse me while I offer him a snack. It wouldn't do for him to see me without some reward." Thoreau handed me the key. "Lock the door, please, Doctor. I don't want you tempted or any neighbor who happens to stroll by. This is my friend's sanctum sanctorum." He entered, and I closed and locked the door. He wasn't gone long. I heard him speak softly to the puma, then, to my surprise, sing a snatch of a French song. Then he was back to the door. "But it was locked," I said. "Only from the outside. Pumas, though intelligent, haven't figured out how to work a door handle, and sometimes I might need to make a quick departure. But I always lock it from without. Ordinarily, Isabel, my housekeeper, does that for me. Did you hear my song? Mon frère likes music, especially old French fur trapper songs. The things we don't know about wild animals. As we walked back to the house, I said, Do you ever let him out?
You mean to slaughter innocent sheep? I'm sure he would like to, but he is too wild, doctor. He escaped once when he was younger, and it took me a fortnight to get him back. He had made his own little den up on East El Tarn. If I let him out now, he wouldn't come back. Captain Black, known alternately by French visitors as Jean Lenoir, by the way, claims his panther would return and that he sold it. But if I were you, I'd check the records of the zoo. No, Dr. Monfrère is and always will be wild. I suppose, to some extent, like me. That's why we write, isn't it? One part of us that can't be tamed. Forgive me, Doctor, but may I ask if, in your service of Sherlock Holmes, you recently had some altercation with a dangerous criminal? I raced in my mind through recent cases, then realized what he meant. I had a fall up near the tarn, I said. Part 5. Mutton Pie. Back at the concierge's desk of the Wordsworth Hotel, I took Thoreau's advice and sent a cable to the Manchester Zoo. When in doubt, eat, my father used to say. So I took myself to the inn for an early supper of mutton pie and ale. The inn was established well over a century ago and had for generations served the village as a public house, and as such it seemed of advantage to me to take most of my meals there where I could pick up any tidbits of local gossip or rumor that might have some bearing on my case. Nevertheless, once my pie was served, I found my mind going to this other case, rather than listening for remarks about a large cat. As I chewed my mutton, I couldn't help but chew over the facts of the case of the purloined letter, as Edgar Allan Poe would have called it, if case it indeed was. First, both of the men owning animals could speak French, Black, for living in French India, and even giving his house a French name, and Thoreau with a French-Canadian name and giving his puma a French name. Also the butler, of course, our girl from Belgium, and possibly the parson, an educated man. Knowing French would be essential to understand that the purloined letter was of a compromising character. Furthermore, with the exception of Parson Thirdly, all of the above persons, and, in addition, the housekeeper, Mrs. Harrison, were admittedly in need of funds, and the sale of a letter such as this one, addressed to a famous poet, now an icon of Victorian morality, would help the cause of their purse. The parson and the butler had the added motive of hating foreigners, and the so-called corruption of English purity. So, where did that put me? Precisely nowhere. Any of them could have paid someone to purloin the letter, or have done it themselves, and as to the beast, my original purpose seemed to have narrowed to two men who may have let their pets loose. It all seemed rather vague and ridiculous. I was wasting my time in this quaint backwater of the kingdom. I would much rather be accompanying Holmes on the quest of a diamond forger. During my cogitations, I had noticed that a man in a suit, tie, and bowler hat, instead of work clothes and cap, had been eyeing me. Then, as I took a last swig of my ale, another man, with gray, bristly whiskers and an unwashed face, decidedly stained trousers, and, I found, foul breath, sidled up to my table and took a seat opposite. "Ashman's the name," he said. "I understand that little governess has been putting the finger of blame on me for simply doing my job. I can't be too careful. If my employer burns something by mistake, it happens. I have to inspect to make sure it's not an important document. But these fragments were all foreign. It was all Greek to me, see? And today I happened to overhear Mr. Wordsworth talking to sour-faced Thornton and denying the whole business that the governess made up in her pretty head to get some attention, lovely young thing that she is, reading all her romance novels. So there you have it, Mr. Londoner, friend of the famous Sherlock Holmes. There ain't no mystery. The girl's an incurable liar. And there's no case there, as you, being the intelligent gentleman that you are, probably already figured out on your own. And the wild beast of the tarn is none other than an Oriental souvenir. So you might as well be on your way back, out of our clear air, into the yellow fog of London." He tipped his hat. "Got all that, have you?" And he strode over to the bar and ordered a whiskey. I had never been such a popular man for people to talk to. I wondered, though, why they all wanted so to vindicate themselves, implicate others, or invalidate the whole affair of the beast or of the letter. Was it just malicious village gossip, or fear of outsiders? I went to the bar to order another ale to further muddle the muddle of my mind. As I leaned an elbow on the bar, the man in the suit and bowler said, "There's a story in your face, of a man who was ready with his fists. I just hope the other fellow looks worse. I had a fall, I said. Treacherous country, this, he said. Crags, cliffs. I prefer a dark city alley any day. He stuck out his hand, and I took it. Rodman, he said. Percival Rodman from the Manchester Morning Star, the North's most important paper, if you haven't heard. I perused it this morning and thought it was the North's most important source of gossip. A man's got to make a living, Governor. What about you? Trailing along with that detective to come up with another story? Me, I do it all myself. At Mount Snowdon, when I exposed that phony climber, I had to learn to climb myself, rope and pick, to see him lowered by his friends to the ledge he said he risked his life climbing to. It was I who risked my life. And now I'm putting my safety against a demon cat. Like you, I've stumbled upon an earth-shaking scandal. Well, at least earth-shaking to literate and to British pride. A French Catholic mistress? An illegitimate child? What would the old queen think of the man who had appointed poet laureate? What do you say? You seem to be saying it all. I'm just curious how you know these rumors at all. An ear, an eye, and an insinuating way, that's what I have. Well, I think I'm going to insinuate myself out of your company, if you don't mind. I took my ale back to my table, and the reporter smiled and saluted me. We're two of a kind, he said, just after a story. A boy came in from the hotel then and delivered me a cable. I tipped him and read. On the 31st of June, a panther was safely delivered to the Manchester Bellevue Zoo from one Captain John Black of Grasmere, Cumbria. Well, that was it then. I would tell the lecturer that the beast was most likely a panther, let out a few times a week to roam on its own at an isolated tarn, and the animal was now safely ensconced in a zoo. As to the possible scandalous letter, what was wrong with a man having a lady friend in France before he was married? Were we such a nation of hypocrites? If anything, it made the man more human, and perhaps shed new light on his poetry. And was any of it true? Although I'd missed my meeting with the charming Miss Jacobs, I was off to London the next morning. I just lit upon that reassuring notion when a boy burst into the inn. I was watching my sheep up Easdale Fell, when, hard by the tarn, I came upon this man, eaten up halfway on the path. But his head was still there, and I recognized that war hero, Captain Black. He was dead, for sure. The inn emptied out soon enough, including the reporter, and I went back to the Wordsworth Hotel. What would I say now to the lecturer? My obtuseness, indecision, and wayward interest in an irrelevant case had not only brought about failure in my mission, the only mission Sherlock Holmes had ever bade me pursue on my own, but in not ascertaining the truth about the beast, I was, indirectly, and I thought morally, responsible for a man's death. Part 6. Easdale Tarn. The next day the village was astir with the news that David Thoreau had been arrested for manslaughter by letting his beast out at night. Others said it was willful murder. As everyone knew, Captain Black took his constitutional up the fell most evenings, and he and the Canadian had never liked each other. Thoreau was further suspicious in that he was a foreigner and had a French name. Then it was revealed that only he had the key to the beast's pen. By late afternoon, it was decided that Thoreau would be sent on to the assizes on the morrow. At the inn, one heard more news of possible guilt. Thoreau had killed the captain for the compromising French letter, which the captain had bought from the butler, or the ashman, or the housekeeper, or the governess, this varied, to pay for his debts. But no such letter was found on Thoreau, or in his house. It was all still a muddle, and once again I resolved to return to London and forget about the case of the purloined letter. I would report to the lecturer what he would assuredly know now from the press, that an escaped puma had done the sheep slaying. I would apologize for my shortcomings to him and admit to myself that, although I observed and recorded Holmes's miraculous faculties, I myself was a decided failure in the art of deduction. Even the cesspool of London at this point made more sense than the clear air and quaint village of the north. Then I had a thought. The lecturer would surely ask if I had seen the tarn myself. I never gone that far up Easdale Fell. I would make a complete investigation. I would go to the tarn myself, see conclusively puma and perhaps human tracks. It was still light, it being July in the north on a balmy evening, and I set out up the fell. I brought both my torch and my old service revolver, my Ely's number 2. It was a long, steep way, but the coolness of the evening helped. and when I finally arrived at the tarn in the late light, I clearly made out large cat tracks in the moist earth on the banks. It was a treeless, bleak, remote place. Although the sky was still light, the water of the tarn was as dark as midnight. Yet I could make out, lodged in the mud not far from shore, the white rib cage and skull of an animal. It was an eerie greeting which the tarn gave me. The grass around where the body was found was trampled by all the onlookers yesterday, but I found another pair of human prints that led away from the tarn. I followed them along the shore to an outcropping of rock, someone taking time away from the crowd, I thought. As I approached the outcropping that looked like a shepherd's old stone hut, I saw it was actually an ancient cairn, built probably thousands of years ago on this lonely spot. It was small, with an opening that, if I bent over, I could barely get through. I now saw there were puma as well as human tracks. Perhaps Thoreau laid his puma here, and did have malicious intent against the captain. I crawled through the opening and smelled animal. There were sheep bones and entrails. I noticed now a mist was creeping up outside the cairn. I had found the beast den, so to speak, and perhaps human complicity. I must leave now, for the mist would soon make the path down the fell hard to navigate. Then the mist crept through a tiny window in the rock I hadn't noticed before, and with it a sliver of early moonlight. It was somehow magnified here. Perhaps the ancient architects had intended the moonrise to enter in this way. Shapes became visible, a stone seat, and beside it, in the corner of the cairn, singular objects, a coil of rope, metal rings, and a type of harness. I stared at those shapes now in the mist, lit by the rising moon, and it all suddenly became clear. Then I sensed something behind me. I turned and saw a black shape through the mist now, a low, poised figure of an animal. But it had something in its mouth that hindered its wanting to spring on me. I remembered now that Thoreau said the puma liked music, that he used to sing to it old French fur trapper songs. I sat on the ancient stone seat as if I were completely unafraid and began to sing softly, slowly, the first thing that came into my mind. Now the time has come, and the leaves are gently turning, where the wild mountain thyme grows around the blooming heather. Will ye go, lassie, go? The puma had now entered the cairn. A sheep's thigh was dangling from his mouth. It brought the thigh over to me, dropped it at my feet, and stared at me. It was an entirely otherworldly moment. That is the only way I can describe it. Sitting on a stone chair in a thousands-year-old cairn, with moon through mist lighting upon the wild eyes of a North American puma, while I sang an old Scottish ballad, was one of the strangest moments of my life. But it didn't last. Another figure crouched now at the mouth of the cairn. It had on a bowler hat and held a drawn pistol. I slowly withdrew from my pocket my own revolver as Rudman spoke. "So you found my climbing tools, have you?" he said. "I thought I had made a mistake with boasting about that climb. Then realized you're Dr. Watson, not Sherlock Holmes. Jake Carpenter at the inn saw you going towards East Elfell Road, so I thought I'd come and make sure Holmes's perspicacity hadn't rubbed off on you. You made it this far. Are you still in the dark?" I didn't say anything. It's usually wise, I've found, when a garrulous, arrogant man has a gun on you, not to say anything that might entice him to act. But I had figured it out. The cat or the puma got your tongue? Well, I waited here to make sure our puma did its job, you see. People like to be interviewed. Complete with notepad, at the Grasmere Tea Room, I asked Thoreau's native housekeeper about his exotic animal and how he kept it, and found out that Thoreau never locked the puma's enclosure from the inside. That was all I needed. That wall of Thoreau's wasn't hard after Mount Snowdon. Then I had to quietly sidle by the trees. That was the hard part. Then I just opened the door and let the puma out. I'd seen the old captain start up the fell. I had to get the letter he had got from the butler. Black wanted to sell it himself. He bragged that he kept it in the safest place, always on him. When I pretended I didn't believe him, he told me proudly he kept it where he always hid a 50-pound note when he went into battle, where no one would steal it if he were wounded. When Mon Frere had his way with him, I simply removed his boot and got the letter intact. Do you know how much that will be worth to my paper? Bringing down a Victorian icon like William Wordsworth, my reputation will forever be made. But It was with those last words of hubris that the puma sprung. Afterwards, I removed the letter, a bit worse for blood stains, from Redmond's waistcoat pocket, folded it carefully, and put it in my own waistcoat. This, the climbing tools in the cairn, and my solemn word, would be my evidence to clear Thoreau. The puma watched as I passed into the mist and disappeared around the tarn. I found the path and started down the fell. I looked back at the stars now shining deep from the belly of the black lake. The moonlight helped a little on the rocky path. My torch merely reflected itself back from the mist. I was thinking I could finally say to Holmes that I had, in some manner, solved a mystery, though, if truth be told, it really solved itself, with the help of Mon Frere. As I pictured myself in our sitting room, and Holmes perhaps saying, "Well done, Watson, you followed it through," or something to that effect, I saw a dark figure approaching up the steep Easdale Fell. "What now?" I thought. I drew my revolver. "There you are, Doctor." It was the lilting voice of Laura Jacobs, the governess. When I inquired at the inn if you had left for London, old Mr. Carpenter said he'd seen you head towards Easdale Fell. I thought you might need some assistance in finding your way down. We wouldn't want you to fall again. You're probably quite handsome under your bruises. I would appreciate the assistance truly, I said. Holmes would have to wait. I might stay a little longer in Grasmere, I thought. It is a lovely little village.
That was James Tipton reading his story, The Beast of Easdale Tarn, from the March-April 2021 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. If you've enjoyed listening to this story, you'll find many others in the magazine at our website, alfredhitchcockmysterymagazine.com. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is published by Dell Magazines and Penny Publications. You can find the magazine at your newsstand. Digital editions are available at all major e-tailers. This podcast was produced with the help of our editorial assistant, Ray Purdom, and our managing editor, Jackie Sherbaugh. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Thanks for listening.